Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. On the road, so we don't have video, and we haven't had for about 2 weeks, and we won't have for another 8 weeks. But we have audio, and today we're going to explore in commentary from Matthew Stein of Truth Out, 400 Chernobyls, solar flares, electromagnetic pulses, and nuclear Armageddon. This is the latest information. Following that, a shorter commentary. This one on the government spends trillions on unlikely threats but won't spend a billion to prevent the very real possibility of global nuclear catastrophe. We're spending money combating the wrong dangers, from Washington Blog. Time permitting, another commentary, Obama takes Bush's secrecy games one step further, by Glenn Greenwald. The latest on healing, why we should not be eating fast foods. From the environment, rapid fire, I have about 15 issues. I will try to address as many of those as possible by giving you brief insights. Then we go to my guest. My guest is Paul Stamets, just arguably the most knowledgeable person I know in the world on fungi and mushrooms. And he's going to talk about mushroom and fungi potentials for saving the world by enhancing health and cleaning up the environment. So that will be an enjoyable contribution. And then, if time permits, I really enjoyed a particular letter that I read from Chip Ward. It's entitled, We Screwed Up, A Letter of Apology to My Granddaughter. Really insightful. So I'll share that if time permits. If not, well, we have another show tomorrow. Let's begin. As many of you who've listened to me for any period of time knows, I don't preach what you should eat. I simply believe that we should not be advocating by demeanment. I believe that we should advocate by positive example. If we want to live a better life, then be the better life, and hopefully other people around you will be inspired by that. We are attracted, I believe, to people who inspire, motivate, stimulate, excite our potential. What are they really doing? We're identifying with something within ourselves that we haven't possibly used at the level we should have. It's like running in the park. There was a time where a couple of us were running together. In fact, I think there were more than a couple. It was about 18 of us. And it was the week before the New York City Marathon. Remember, there was Frank and Sam, and we were pounding around the park. We did 12 miles, but we were doing them at a six-minute pace. I remember how easy it was. 5 minute, 5:30, not a problem uphill. And someone said, that's an awful fast pace. And they were right, until you see guys running by at 4 minutes a mile. And a couple of guys wanted to catch up with them. And we ran for a mile trying to catch these guys who were just in normal conversation running like they were running at a 10-minute pace. And we couldn't keep up with them. It absolutely exhausted us. We paid for it the next week because we didn't do the marathons we want because we weren't running at our pace. I believe that we have to identify with people who are challenging us. They're a little faster. Maybe they're a little more disciplined. Possibly they're a little more creative. Maybe they're willing to do things we're not. Maybe they're willing to turn off television. What a radical concept when you hear someone say, I don't have a television. But what about those who say, yeah, I have a television, but I only watch something that's empowering, and I refuse to watch anything else. All right, that raises the bar. It stimulates us. And something within us says, well, I could do that. What about the person that eats right? What about the person that pays attention to how they respond to people and what they do each day? So what I believe is instead of, you know, a hard push, we should do a soft effort. And those who want to hear will, and those who don't won't be offended. We won't be transgressing that boundary, and I believe there should be a boundary. When people don't want our help, they have every right not to want our help. Could you imagine if you were in a restaurant and someone came in and stood over you and said, do you realize what's in that French fry? Do you realize what's that? You know what? Clearly, the person doesn't want to know or they'd come and ask you, or they wouldn't be there. So if you want to inspire more people to pay attention to what they should do, always approach them gently and ask them if they want any input. If they don't, honor that. That's especially hard when it comes to our own family because we love our family. We don't want to see them dying, and yet almost universally they reject anything we have. Now it comes to fast foods. And now a lot of people are saying, yeah, it's tasty. I like the way it tastes. And I'm used to it. I'm addicted to it. And it's cheap. You know, a dollar cheeseburger. Here's where I believe we have an opportunity. Say, fine. No problem. I just don't want you being deceived by what you're eating. What do you mean? Would you eat and pay a dollar for pink slime, which is scrap meat that they douse with ammonium hydroxide? What do you mean, scrap meat? Well, that's meat that's not really fit for human consumption because it would spread salmonella or E. coli. That's the meat that they scrape off the bones. And that whole process, it makes it more easily contaminated. And they treat it with this chemical, same kind of chemical you find under your sink for cleaning floors. I just want to, you know, give you that information. What you do with it's up to you, but I value your health and don't want to see you deceived. Then at least people have an understanding. It's just like McDonald's McNuggets. Okay, fine. People like them. I've never eaten them, but I'm assuming that they're very tasty for most people's conditioned taste. What is the go-to line there? Well, if people like their McNuggets, would they like them as much if they knew what that so-called meat contained, the sub-ingredients? Instead of using real meat, how about walking up to the counter and say, I want some of that sodium phosphate, safflower oil, wheat starch, dextrose, and autolyzed yeast extract? That's really toxic. That's like MSG. And then, of course, throw in a silicone substance used as an anti-foaming agent and often found in breast implants and silly putty. It's a dimethyl polysilicoxane. I see. Not quite the same way that it rolls off the tongue as McNuggets, but that's what it is. So those are the ingredients that we get that we're not aware of. So I think that we could do a service if we just passed on the information to those who are open to it, that you're getting a lot of stuff you don't want, wouldn't want, but it's bad for you. Then it's up to them. Now, something that I know many of you appreciate is starting your day by building your immune system. And one of the ways historically people have started their day, especially in Europe, is by having a glass of fresh lemon water. You take the juice of three lemons and you squeeze it, roll it first, and then you squeeze it. And then you can actually wash the lemon and then dice the lemon and blend it. And you can do it that way. That's where you're getting all of it. But if you just want the juice, that's fine. And what will that do? That's it. That's that simple. Lemon in water. It helps boost your immunity. That's correct. Lemon water is known to stimulate and detoxify the liver. And the liver is one organ in the body that it comes under so much assault because of toxic additives and hazardous chemicals and even alcohol consumption in any amount. So in biological ionization as applied to human nutrition, they had a whole article in there on lemon water. It's very high in vitamin C and potassium, and that's good. And that also helps people with stress. So start your day with, even before you go out for a workout, the juice of three lemons in some water. All right? And if it's a little tart for you, then put some raw Tupelo honey in there. Now, something you should be getting every day is your vitamin D. I mentioned that yesterday. Well, now today there's an American Journal of Cardiology article done at the University of Kansas. It says, quote, vitamin D supplements may help you live longer and help reduce cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and boost survival of older people. Quote, because vitamin D deficiency is widespread, strategies directed at population-based supplement programs – could prove beneficial. So that's good news. How much? 2,000 to 5,000 units a day would be terrific for you, and that would help you. Berries. Another study on berries. And this is a good study, and here's what it says. It says berry juice shows anti-inflammatory and heart benefits. I'll quote this. And this was at the European Global Monitoring for Environmental and Security. It says, quote, lignanberry, cranberry, black currant juices may reduce compounds that promote inflammation and reduce atherosclerosis. In this study, they measured in the laboratory lowering high blood pressure. This was done at the University of Helsinki in Valio. And they said that the berry juices were associated with reductions in the levels of compounds linked to inflammation, including monocyte protein 1 and cyclooxygenase 2, that's COX-2. In addition, lignanberry juice was linked to significant reductions in biomarkers that are involved in damage to cells called soluble adhesion molecules and interadhesion molecules in particular. Quote, the present study was, as far as we know, the first long-term in vivo experiment in which mechanisms of favorable vascular effects of Finnish berries, by the way, there's not just Finnish berries, you can get them all over the world now, were studied at cellular and molecular levels, focusing on inflammation and thrombosis. And that was published in the Journal of Functional Foods also. So in lay language, here's what it says. These berries have compounds that turn off inflammation. So if you have berries every day, that's good. That would be my first choice. Buy some organic berries if you can't find them fresh, because most of them are seasonal. Then buy them frozen, because they flash freeze them right after harvesting, washing, sorting, and then they flash freeze them. So they still contain their nutrients and taste and orac and everything else. Then the next way for most people would be to have a concentrate. You can get cranberry concentrate. Don't get cranberry juice with the sugar, but and black currant concentrate. The third and most powerful way would be to get powders that contain them, because you're going to get far more of the actual active ingredient in the powder. Why? Simple reductionism. You start off with, let's say, black currants. These are tiny little black berries, and they're dark, and they come along with red currants and even white currants. And they originally were found all over Europe, common in almost every house in Europe and Eastern Europe. Later would be found in the United States. And they're tart. Most people don't like them because they're a little bitter. So over there, they would put them into black currant jam. And the best, of course, would be using a honey or a non-calorigenic sweetener. Now, do you realize how many black currants you would have to juice to get 2 ounces of the actual juice? And then what is the 2 ounces? 96% is water. So then you eliminate the water, you're left with a speck of this. So to get something that is therapeutically beneficial, you have to get it in its most concentrated form, especially if it's raw and hasn't been heated. And then when you rehydrate it by adding water, you're getting something that could be 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 times more powerful. So that's what we should be doing each day to help our bodies. And this is just one more of dozens of studies that show that it's beneficial for us. And finally, hot pepper compound can help hearts. This is from the American Chemical Society, and I'll quote this. And this was also sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Quote, the food that inspires wariness is on course for inspiring even more wonder. From a medical standpoint, a scientist today reported the latest evidence that chili peppers are heart-healthy food with potential to protect against the number one cause of death in the developing world. The report was part of the national meeting and exposition of the American Chemical Society, the world's largest scientific society. The study focused on capsaicin, its fiery hot relatives, and a substance term capsaicinoids, the stuff that gives cayennes and jalapenos and other chili peppers their heat. Capsaicin already has an established role in medicine in rub-on skin creams to treat arthritis and certain forms of pain. Past research suggests that spicing food with chilies can lower blood pressure in people of that condition, reduce blood cholesterol, and ease the tendency for dangerous blood clots to form. This is from Dr. Chen. Quote, our research has reinforced the expanding knowledge about how these substances in chilies work in improving heart health. We now have the clearer, more detailed portrait of their innermost effects on genes and their mechanisms of influence to lower cholesterol and to help have healthier blood vessels. It is among the first research to prove this information. Well, that means that having peppers on a regular basis is absolutely good for your heart. I'm Gary Noll. Now to our environmental segment before we take a little break here. I'm going to go through a lot of things rapidly just to get as much of this out to you as possible. All of this is posted on our website. First up, from Glenn Ashton. This is in the Seattle Times. This is where Bill Gates resides, and it's surprising to be able to get this in the newspaper, but good for Glenn for doing so. The letter says, Bill Gates' support for genetically modified crops is wrong approach for Africa. I'll quote just a couple paragraphs. He says, Bill Gates' support for genetically modified crops as a solution for world hunger is of concern to those of us involved in promoting sustainable, equitable, and effective agricultural policies in Africa. There are two primary shortcomings to Gates' approach. First, his technocratic ideology runs counter to the best informed science. The World Bank and the United Nations funded 900 independent scientists over 3 years in order to create an international assessment of agricultural knowledge and science and technology for development. Its conclusions were diametrically opposed at both philosophical and practical levels to those espoused by Gates and the genetically modified companies, such as Monsanto. The group suggests that rather than pursuing industrial farming models, agroecology, the methods provided that would create the best global food security, especially in light of climate change, are the traditional seed varieties, local farming practices adapted to the local ecology over the millennia. Agroecology has consistently proven capable of sustaining increased productivity. That means agroecology is organic. Conversely, the present genetically modified crops generally have not increased yields over the long run, despite their increased cost and dependence on agricultural chemicals, as highlighted in the Union of Concerned Scientists report, failed to yield. For example, experimental drought-resistant corn supported by Gates and Monsanto is far less robust than natural maize varieties and farming methods requiring less water. Thus, Gates' genetically modified solutions depend on higher cost inputs, such as fertilizers, pest controls, and the special seeds themselves, distracting attention from proven lower cost approaches. So, thank you, Glenn Ashton, for writing in the Seattle Times to challenge Bill Gates. Bill Gates is on the wrong side of this issue, but this man has the power and the wealth to try to buy a truth. And in the short term, those with wealth and power can buy the truth, but not a universal truth. Sooner or later, they'll be found wrong. From Common Dream staff, on the brink, the planet is near irreversible point of global warming. Quote, scientists issue dire call for action on climate change at a conference. We must stop warming or cross the threshold. Quote, we may have already passed the tipping points on global warming, say scientists at the Planet Under Pressure conference. At the London conference, scientists are giving a bleak view of the future of the planet due to catastrophic damage and growth by humans, saying we are close to the irreversible point of global warming. Will Steffen, executive director of the Australian National University's Climate Change Institute, gave an urgent warning that humanity needs to act radically or climate change, quote, we can cap temperature rise at 2 degrees or cross the threshold beyond which the systems shift to a much hotter state, unquote. But Bob Watson, former head of the UN's climate panel and chief advisor to Britain's environmental ministry, stated that the world had already passed any hope of limiting global warming to 2 degrees Celsius and stated that, quote, we have just not acted. The need for action is becoming more and more urgent with every day that passes. And finally, Martin Rees of the Royal Society, Britain's Academy of Sciences, stated to This Century, quote, this is the first when one species, ours, humans, has the planet's future in its hands. Now, the rest of this goes on to say that we are at or past this. Now, my thought is simple. I do not believe that anything anyone will say or do can make any difference. I say that based upon not being cynical or negative, but I've spent so much time, thousands of hours, in preparation and in filming of my documentary over a long period of time on the 12 tipping points. When you've looked at as much data, you've studied as many studies, interviewed as many experts, done as much filming, you then pull back and you have to be honest and objective and say, who cares? And I would say 10% of the American population care deeply. That's good. You bet. Well, what about the 90%? They don't care, and they're not going to care tomorrow. They're selfish. They're self-absorbed. They could be absolutely watching Katrina all over again. And if you want to know my opinion about that, go back and read my editorial I did at the time about why so many people didn't leave who had a chance to. We're doing the same thing now. We're mocking potential cataclysmic events that are going to happen. It's just when will they happen and to what extent will it impact us. So the good news is for the 10%, you're not policymakers nor opinion leaders. You're not a part of the official institutions that can make a difference. So my suggestion is continue sharing information of what to do for yourself and for those 30 million Americans or so who want to protect themselves and want to help other people, but the other people are saying no. So help yourself. You have time, and that's why I will continue to do a series of articles and films showing you what can you do, where the best places to live, how to prepare yourself. These are the things that we must do because this administration and no administration is going to do a damn thing because even when given the opportunity to, they know that they cannot do anything because to do so would be to challenge the people that give them checks, the polluting industries that cause this, or to ask for lifestyle modification that the average person is not going to agree to, like giving up meat. People are not going to, and all the industries that are based upon it, and all the ads on television for it. So they're simply going to do a soft shoe shuffle, smiling and waving as they back off the stage and telling people exactly what they want to hear. Of course we're interested in global warming. Of course we have special panels, but there is some controversy. Is there real or not? And we're looking into it, and we've selected a panel. And all this is just a manipulation. It's real. It's happening. We will get slammed by three major cataclysmic events in the next 2 years. Mark my words on that. And then let's go talk with Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and people on the left and this president and the others and all members of Congress and say, you said it wouldn't happen. It did. But until such time that our entire society breaks down, we cannot have a breakthrough. There is no such thing as anyone relinquishing power of any paradigm, any institution in America. Not going to happen. That is not a negative. In fact, I think it's very positive because once you see what the game is, you can choose not to play, in which case then you can prepare yourself in a way that's meaningful and positive. Here's another thing from the Journal of Glaciology. The West Antarctic shelves are tearing apart at the seams. Quote, a new study examining nearly 40 years of satellite imagery has revealed that the floating ice shelves of a critical portion of West Antarctica are steadily losing their grip on adjacent bay walls, potentially amplifying an already accelerated loss of ice to the sea. The most extensive record yet of the evaluation of the floating ice shelves in the eastern area of West Antarctica show that their margins, where they grip onto rock bay walls or slower ice masses, are fracturing and retreating inland. As that grip continues to loosen, these already thinning ice shelves will be even less able to hold back grounded ice upstream. This, according to the University of Texas at Austin's Institute for Geophysics, and reported in the Journal of Glaciology. Now, what does this mean in lay language? This means that around all of Iceland and Greenland and Antarctica, you have barriers, like a doorstop. Those are breaking. That means that massive amounts of ice that is on the rock, not yet in the water, are going to be free to flow right into the ocean, which means that we could have an enormous increase in ocean rise overnight if this stuff starts to melt and break off, which I believe it will, and almost everyone else in the field believes that it will. Also, another sign that this is happening, signs of thawing permafrost reveal from space. Quote, this is again from a different group. Satellites are seeing changes in land surfaces in high detail at northern latitudes, indicating thawing permafrost. This releases greenhouse gases and parts into parts of the Arctic, exacerbating the effects of climate change. Permafrost is ground that remains at or below zero for at least two consecutive years and usually appears in areas at high altitudes such as Alaska, Siberia, northern Scandinavia, or at high altitudes like the Andes, Himalayas, or the Alps. About half the world's underground organic carbon is found in northern permafrost regions. This is more than double the amount of carbon in the atmosphere in the form of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and methane. The effects of climate change are most severe and rapid in the Arctic, causing the permafrost to thaw. When it does, it releases greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, exacerbating the effects of climate change. Although permafrost cannot be directly measured from space, factors such as surface temperatures, land cover, and snow perimeters, soil moisture, and terrain changes can be captured by satellites. And it's happening at an accelerated rate. So, those are just some of the latest on environmental issues. Now, back in a moment with my commentary on 400 Chernobyls, then our guest. Please stay with us. All of you, I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to be going to our guest as soon as I complete this. That is Paul Stamets. Paul is regarded by many as perhaps the world's foremost authority on the ecology and properties of fungi and mushrooms. He is the founder of the Fungi Perfectory, which for 30 years has led the supplemental industry on research about medicinal mushrooms. And he's traveled the world studying fungi and mushrooms and their place in evolution and their use medicinally, and we'll talk with him about that. He's an advisor of the Program for Integrative Medicine, University of Arizona Medical School, and he's authored several books, and we'll talk with him about how the mushroom and fungi could save the world by enhancing health and cleaning the environment. But first, as I promised, I'm concerned about solar storms. I have an article, and we are updating the article, and I'll have new information within the week, but the current one is certainly a great starting point about the solar flares that are coming. And I'm putting this in context of, wouldn't it have been nice had we really told the truth about Katrina and its capacity to breach the walls, the levees, around New Orleans? We would have saved over 2,000 lives and 150,000 people from being made homeless. but we didn't tell the truth. So here is the truth of it. From Matthew Stein of Truth Out, there are 450 nuclear reactors in the world, with hundreds more being planned or under construction. Now, there are 104 of these reactors in the United States and 195 in Europe. Imagine what havoc it would wreak on our civilization and the planet's ecosystems if we were to suddenly witness not just one or two nuclear meltdowns, but 400 or more. All right? How likely is this that our world might experience an event that could ultimately cause hundreds of reactors to fail and melt down at approximately the same time? I venture to say that unless we take significant protective measures, this scenario is not only possible, but probable. Consider the ongoing problems caused by the three reactor core meltdowns and explosions and breached containment vessels at Japan's Fukushima facility and the subsequent health and environmental issues. Consider the millions of innocent civilians who have already died or continue to suffer from horrific radiation-related health problems. Chernobyl was just one example. And this could result from the Chernobyl reactor explosions and fires and fallouts. Just imagine that each one of ours becomes another Chernobyl or another Fukushima. If just two serious nuclear disasters spaced 25 years apart could cause such horrendous environmental catastrophes, it's hard to imagine how we could ever hope to recover from hundreds of similar nuclear incidents occurring simultaneously across the planet, since more than one-third of all Americans live within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant. This is a serious issue that should be given, I believe, top priority. In the past 152 years, Earth has been struck roughly 100 solar times, meaning solar storms. These have caused significant geomagnetic disturbances, two of which were powerful enough to rank as extreme. And if an extreme geomagnetic disturbance of such magnitude were to occur today, in all likelihood, it would initiate a chain of events leading to catastrophic failures at the vast majority of our world's nuclear reactors, similar to but over 100 times worse than disasters of both Chernobyl and Fukushima. Remember, at Chernobyl and Fukushima, you still had other energy. You had electricity. You had capacity to do something. With this one, you won't have any electricity. You won't have any responders. You won't have anyone knowing what has happened. When massive solar flares launch a huge mass of highly charged plasma, which is a corneal mass ejection, directly towards Earth, colliding with our planet's outer atmosphere and magnetosphere, the result is a significant geomagnetic disturbance. The last extreme geomagnetic disturbance of a magnitude that collapsed much of the U.S. grid was in May of 1921, long before the advent of modern electronics, widespread electrical power grids, and nuclear power plants. We are mostly, blissfully, unaware of this threat and unprepared for its consequences. The good news is that relatively affordable equipment and processes could be installed to protect critical components to the electrical grid and its nuclear reactors today, therefore averting this end, as we know it, of life, quality of life at least, scenario. The bad news is that even though panels of scientists and engineers have studied the problem, and the bipartisan Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission has presented a list of specific recommendations to Congress, none of our leaders have yet to approve and implement any significant preventative measure. Most of us believe that an emergency like this could never happen, and that if it could, our authorities would do everything in their power to prevent such an apocalyptic event. Not true. In fact, the opposite is true. They would say, how could this happen? Well, let's take an in-depth look. Our current global system of electrical power generation and distribution is the grid, upon which our modern lifestyles are utterly dependent. And it's extremely vulnerable to severe geomagnetic storms, which tend to strike our planet on an average of approximately once every 70 to 100 years. We depend upon this grid to maintain food production and distribution, telecommunications, internet services, medical services, military defense, transportation, government, water treatment, sewage, garbage removal, refrigeration, oil refining, gas pumping, all forms of commerce. Unfortunately, the world's nuclear power plants, as they are currently designed, are critically dependent upon maintaining connection to a fundamental electrical grid for all but relatively short periods of electrical blackouts in order to keep the reactor cores continuously cooled so as to avoid catastrophic reactor core meltdowns and fires in storage ponds for spent fuel rods. If an extreme geomagnetic event were to cause widespread grid collapse, which it most certainly will, in as little as 1 or 2 hours after each nuclear reactor's facility's backup generators either fail to start or run out of fuel, the reactor cores will start to melt down. After a few days without electricity to run the cooling system pumps, the water bath covering the spent fuel rods stored in spent fuel ponds will boil away, allowing the stored fuel rods to melt down and burn. And since the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, one of the most corrupt organizations in American history, completely and totally in the pocket of the major nuclear industry groups, currently mandates that only 1 week, let me repeat that, 1 week, one more time, 7 days supply of backup generator fuel is needed to be stored at each reactor site, it is likely that after we witness the spectacular nighttime celestial light show from the next extreme event, we will have about 1 week in which to prepare ourselves for exposure to that radiation. To do nothing is to behave like ostriches with our heads in the sand, blindly believing that everything will be okay. As our world drifts towards the next natural, inevitable superstorm, resulting in extreme problems, such a storm will end the industrialized world as we know it, creating almost incalculable suffering, death, and environmental destruction on a scale not since the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Think that's an exaggeration? Think again. There are records from the 1850s to today of roughly 100 significant geomagnetic solar storms, two of which in the last 25 years were strong enough to cause millions of dollars worth of damage to key components that keep our modern grid powered. In March of 1989, a severe solar storm induced powerful electrical current in grids wiring that fried a main power transformer in the Hydro-Quebec system, causing a cascading grid failure that knocked out power to 6 million customers for 9 hours and damaging similar transformers in New Jersey and the UK. More recently, in 2003, a less intense but longer storm, solar storm, caused a blackout in Sweden and induced powerful currents in the South African grid that severely damaged or destroyed 14 of their major power transformers, impairing commerce and comfort for over a major portion of that country as it was forced to resort to any kind of rolling blackout that it could handle. During the great geomagnetic storm of May 1415-1921, brilliant displays of sparkling light were reported in the northern hemisphere as far south as Mexico and Puerto Rico, and in the southern hemisphere as far north as Mexico. This extreme storm produced ground currents roughly 10 times as strong as the 1989 Quebec incident. Just 62 years later, the great granddaddy of recorded storms, referred to as the Carrington Effect, raged from August 28th to September 4th, 1859. This extreme solar storm induced currents so powerful that telegraph lines, towers, and stations caught on fire at a number of locations around the world. Best estimates are that the Carrington Effect was approximately 50% stronger than the 1921 storm. Since we're headed into an active solar period, much like the one preceding the Carrington Effect, scientists are concerned that the conditions could be ripe for the next extreme storm. Prior to the advent of the microchip and modern high-voltage transformers, key grid components that were first introduced in the late 1960s, most electrical systems were relatively robust and resistant to the effects of these storms. given that a simple electrostatic spark can fry a microchip and thousands of miles of power lines could act like giant antennas for capturing massive amounts of the GMD-spawned electromagnetic energy, modern electrical systems are far more vulnerable than their predecessors. The federal government recently sponsored a detailed scientific study to better understand how much critical components of our national electrical grid might be affected by either a naturally occurring storm or a man-made EPM. Under the auspices of the EMP Commission and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and reviewed in depth by Oak Ridge National Laboratory and the National Academy of Sciences, Meditech Corporation undertook extensive modeling and analysis of the potential effects of extreme geomagnetic storms on the U.S. electrical power grid. And based upon a storm as intense as the 1921 storm, Meditech estimated within the United States, induced voltage and current spikes combined with harmonic anomalies would severely damage or destroy over 350 of our major power transformers, which are absolutely critical to the functioning of the U.S. grid and possibly impact well over 2,000 transformers worldwide. Now, these EHV transformers, these are the major grids, are made to order. You can't just go buy them. They're custom designed for each installation. They weigh about 300 tons. They cost over $1 million. Given that there is currently a three-year waiting list for a single transformer due to a recent demand from China and India, lead times grew from 1 to 3 years, and that the total global manufacturing capacity is roughly 100 of these transformers per year. When the world's manufacturing centers are functioning properly, you can begin to grasp the implications of widespread transformer losses. The loss of thousands of these transformers worldwide would cause a catastrophic grid collapse across much of the industrialized world. It will take years at best for the industrialized world to put itself back together after such an event, especially considering the fact that most of the manufacturing centers that make up this equipment will also be grappling with widespread grid failure. So I got a question. If China loses, let's say, half of its grids, and it has 16 of the 25 largest cities in the world, is it likely to honor an order for the United States to give it a power grid or to go ahead and create grids for its own cities? This is our nuclear Achilles heel. 5 years ago, I visited the still highly contaminated areas of Ukraine and Belarus border where much of the radioactive plume from Chernobyl descended on April 26, 1986. I challenged Chief Scientist John Beddington and environmentalists like George Monabat or any of the other pundits now downplaying the risk of radiation, talk to the doctors, the scientists, the mothers, the children, the villagers who have been left with the consequences of a major nuclear accident. It was grim. Going from hospital to hospital and from one contaminated village to another, finding deformed and genetically mutated babies in the wards, pitifully sick children in the homes, adolescents with stunted growth and dwarfed torsos, fetuses without thighs and fingers, and villagers who were told that everyone in their family was sick. This was 20 years after the accident. But we heard of many unusual clusters of people with rare bone cancers, villagers testifying about what was called the Chernobyl necklace, thyroid cancer. It was so common as to be unremarkable. What do an extended grid blackouts have to do with potential nuclear catastrophes? It's simple. Nuclear power plants are designed to disconnect automatically from the grid in the event of a local power failure or major grid anomaly. Once disconnected, they begin the process of shutting down the reactor's core. In the event of the loss of coolant flow to an active nuclear reactor's core, the reactor will start to melt down and fail catastrophically within a matter of a few hours at most. In an extreme event, nearly every reactor in the world would be adversely affected. It was a short-term cooling system failure that caused a partial reactor meltdown in March 1979 at Three Mile Island, Pennsylvania. Similarly, according to Japanese authorities, it was not direct damage from Japan's 9.0 magnitude earthquake on March 11, 2011 that caused the Fukushima nuclear reactor disaster, but the loss of electricity to the reactor's cooling system pumps when the reactor's backup batteries and diesel generators were wiped out by the ensuing tidal wave. in the hours and days after the tidal wave shuttered the cooling systems, the cores of reactors number 1, 2, and 3 were in full meltdown and released hydrogen gas exploding fuel, which breached several reactor containment vessels and blew the roof off the building housing reactor number 4 and spent fuel storage ponds. Of even greater damage and concern than the reactor cores themselves are the spent fuel rods stored in on-site cooling ponds. Lacking a permanent spent nuclear facility, which we don't have anywhere right now, they do these temporary nuclear fuel containment ponds, and they're featured outside of the reactors. They typically contain the accumulated spent fuel from 10 or more decommissioned reactor cores. And due to a lack of permanent repository, most of these fuel containment ponds are greatly overloaded and tightly packed beyond original design. They are generally surrounded by common light industrial buildings with concrete walls and corrugated steel roofs, unlike the active reactor cores, which are encased inside massive containment vessels with thick walls of concrete and steel. The buildings surrounding spent fuel rods storage ponds will do practically nothing to contain radioactive contamination in the event of a prolonged cooling system failure. Well, since spent fuel rods typically hold far greater quantities of highly radioactive material than the active nuclear reactors locked inside reinforced containment vessels, they clearly present far greater potential for the catastrophic spread of highly radioactive contaminants over huge swaths of land, polluting everything. Nothing in 200 miles will protect you. Nothing. So, reactor fuel rods have a protective zirconium cladding, which, if superheated while exposed to air, will burn with intense self-generating heat, much like a magnesium fire, releasing highly radioactive aerosols and smoke. And how would you know? You wouldn't. You'd just be breathing it in. From Matthew Stein, so my concern is simple. Let us do the following. Let us demand now that those, especially on the left, please start focusing on something that's truly important for all of our survival. Closing down our nuclear power plants is more important than any other social issue we're faced with. And yet there is nothing being done about it. We are trying to do the best we can. We have 20 leading spokespersons willing to go on any television show, radio show, to discuss, to debate this. We have a panel. We have a documentary, a multi-award-winning documentary, Knocking on the Devil's Door. We have dozens of articles. And we have grassroots activist organizations who are encouraging people to pay attention to the obvious. You do not want a solar storm hitting where you cannot control the outcome. And I haven't even gotten to the electromagnetic pulse attack. I will save that for another show. Let your legislators know, all your legislators, your state legislators, your federal legislators, the president, you want, at the very least, here's what we want. We want backup surge protectors on all of our grids and surge protectors on all of our nuclear power plants and at least 12 months worth of backup storage fuel at all of our nuclear facilities. That's something we should all be demanding. I'm Gary Noll. Let's now go over and say hello to our guest who is standing by. Thanks a lot for your patience standing by, Paul.
Well, thank you, Gary. That was a little heavy, but very appropriate, and actually makes a nice little follow-in to what I'm going to talk about. So I am a specialist in medicinal mushrooms, as I was on your show, I think, about 10 years ago. And I think this speaks to the fact that we are reflections of our environment. And if our environment is diseased or toxic, then we incur the effects of those toxins on our health. So it's very apropos that you talk about radiation and which causes free radicals. And we all have cancer all the time, and nature's a numbers game. And the more that you can stack the variables on your side of the equation, that leads to better health, then that's where I think these mushrooms come in and play a very important role.
Good. Well, take us through, please, why mushrooms are important and fungi, what they do, and how we should be using them.
Well, mushrooms were the mycelium and fungi were the first organisms that came onto land from the ocean about 1.3 billion years ago. We share a common ancestry with fungi, separating from fungi about 650 million years ago. And the resident form of fungi is in the form of mycelium. This is a cobwebby-like growth that's literally under every footstep that you take on the ground. And these are fine filaments, and there can be more than 8 miles of these fungal threads in a single cubic inch of soil. In fact, these make up the food web of nature. And as these fungi grow out, they can become quite large. In fact, the largest organism in the world now is a fungal mat, 2,200 acres in size, in eastern Oregon, of a honey mushroom. And that mat is over 2,000 years in age. Now, the mycelium remains resident in the ecosystem, and then once in a while it surfaces and erupts into a mushroom, which is the reproductive or the fruit of the fungus. Much like the apple is to the roots of an apple tree, the mushroom is to the mycelium that is growing underground. But this organism achieves such a huge mass, over 2,000 acres in size, is only one cell wall thick. Now, how is it possible? We have 5 or 6 skin cells that protect us from infection. The mycelium only has one. How is it possible that the mycelium can achieve the largest mass of any organism in the world and yet only have one cell wall thick, on the other side of which are hundreds of millions of microbes per gram that are trying to consume it? And it speaks to the host defensive immunity that these fungi have developed in being able to keep pathogens away. And we can very much make use of that. Now, mushrooms are not well understood because they're so ephemeral. Well, we see plants, and they come up, and they stay around for months or years. But mushrooms only come up for a few days, and they disappear. So it's not unreasonable that science and people in general would not understand mushrooms because they're so ephemeral. And that which is ephemeral and so short-lived but so powerful, they can heal you, they can feed you, they can kill you. And it's not surprising that science has been slow to recognize mushrooms as a fantastic source of novel medicines.
Good. Go through the mushrooms that we could be using daily, and how would you suggest we use them? In a salad, a sautéed, in a soup? And how have other cultures used them?
Oh, excellent. Well, all mushrooms, with the exception of truffles, should be cooked. Mushrooms have chitinous-like cell walls that are indigestible. So, unfortunately, the majority of button mushrooms in this country are eaten raw, and they give you almost no nutritional benefit whatsoever in comparison to cooking them. So sautéing them, putting them, boiling them in water and soups, etc., confer a lot more nutritional advantage than you would otherwise get. Truffles are eaten for flavor, so they tend to be shaved, and they're typically not cooked. And when you cook them, you lose that volatile oil that makes them taste so good. But that's an exception to the rule, and generally, a mushroom should be cooked. So I personally eat shiitake several times a week, enoki mushrooms and maitake mushrooms. These are all very, very delicious edible mushrooms, but there's also many, many studies now showing that mushrooms can help your immune system. Now, one of my core philosophies is that habitats have immune systems, just like we do, but mushroom mycelium are the cellular bridges that connect the two. And when you eat mushrooms, you're eating these polysaccharide-rich and protein-rich fruits, but the mycelium has a unique set of compounds that can help the immune system. And our group is funded by a $2.1 million NIH-funded breast cancer clinical study using our turkey tail mushrooms. And this study has been completed. It has been accepted in a medical journal, and the results are very positive. But I've been supplying these mushrooms of these turkey tails, which are leathery like mushrooms. They grow on every woodland in the world, but you really can't chew them. They're very tough. And we supplied in a comparative study with 5 other different groups, and our mushroom mycelial products came out number one. And so we've been supplying these, but then this really hit home to me in June of 2009. And my mother, who is deeply religious, called me up, and she said, "Paul, I'm scared. I want to talk to you about something, but you're always so busy." It's a terrible entrance to a conversation. And I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she said, "My right breast is 5 times the size of my left. I have 6 angry lymph nodes on my right side that are swollen and angry. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to admit I started crying, saying, 'Why didn't you tell me sooner? How long has this been going on?' And she said, "It was for 2 years. So in June of 2009, I spent most of the month with my mother at breast cancer clinics, at the Swedish breast cancer clinic in Seattle.
Paul, let me just interrupt for a second here, saying those of you who listen to only 55 minutes of the show, we want to say goodbye. You're listening to Paul Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S. His website is fungi.com, F-U-N-G-I.com. But we're going to continue for the next 6 minutes on the Internet. Please continue now, Paul.
Okay. And so on the second visit, my mother and I were told that she had advanced stage 4 breast cancer. Her tumor in her right breast was in excess of 5.5 centimeters. It had metastasized. It went into her liver, went into her sternum. And then, you know, we asked, and as everyone would, how much time? And she was given less than 3 months to live. And we had a circle meeting, as many families do, and we planned her exit. She's very organized. But she had not seen a doctor since 1968. She is too old for a mastectomy and for radiation therapy, so the doctor said, really, there's nothing that we can do for you, but there's a chemo drug called Herceptin, which is wonderful. We can give you that, but it's unlikely to, you know, help you because of your age. And then the doctor said, but there's an interesting breast cancer clinical study going on at Bastyr Medical School. You might want to take these turkey tail mushrooms. And that's when my mother chimed in, well, my son's providing them. So my mother started taking 8 turkey tail capsules per day in combination with her chemo treatments. And I'm very thankful to say 3 years later, she has no detectable tumors. And this has been, you know, fantastic news. And yesterday she had her 6th MRI and CT scanned, and she was totally clear. And so it's a really remarkable event that, and I'm so proud and honored that being the son, I could, you know, come to the forefront to help my mother overcome her cancer. So this is, I think, the proverbial tip of the iceberg, is that these mushrooms are great adjuncts to conventional therapy to help the immune system overcome the battle with cancer. And I think has widespread implications for many.
Paul, 2 short answers, if you would, please. The Japanese and the Chinese are well known for using mushrooms medicinally and in also using them in their dishes. Talk about the way that they have used them and which ones they've used, and what can we do that might benefit from that?
Well, in China, in Japan and Asia in general, and as well as in Eastern Europe, the way of preparing mushrooms typically was cooking them and boiling them in water to make teas. So traditional Chinese medicine advocates boiling mushrooms in hot water to make teas and soups. Well, reishi mushrooms, which is a hard polypore and turkey tails, shiitake and miso soup, enoki mushrooms, etc. That's been the common way. But with the advent of modern scientific methods where we're doing in vitro propagation, growing the mycelium in clean room laboratories, we've really opened up a whole new landscape of potential novel medicines coming from the mycelium. And so the mycelial aspect is a kind of a new chapter in the science of medicinal mushrooms, which now has really propelled the research far more forward than that originated in Asia. So this is very exciting because now we have a whole new repertoire of active ingredients and new pathways to discovering medicines that can help the immune system.
All right, so one of the traditional soups would be a miso soup, and they almost always put shiitake mushrooms, garlic, tofu, miso paste, and scallions in there. Each one of those has known anti-cancer properties. All of them together certainly makes a very enticing and tasty therapeutic soup. We should be doing more of that.
And multiple mushrooms are definitely what I believe in, because every mushroom has a unique molecular architecture. And as they're digested, they activate different receptor sites in the immune system in a unique way. After the field of receptor sites are flooded with one species, more necessary is not better, but a different species can activate other subsets of receptor sites to create a synergistic reaction. And we've actually proven this in the laboratory, and a 7-species blend that we produce activated the immune system far more than any one species by itself at the same dose.
What are those species? What are those 7?
Those 7 are reishi, maitake, chaga, misima, which is a wonderful mushroom from the island of the woman in Korea.
Spell
it. Misima is M-E-S-I-M-A. Chaga is a birch mushroom that grows on trees and shiitake.
Spell that.
Chaga, C-A-G-A.
Okay.
And
one more.
Okay. I'm doing this from memory now, so you have to forgive me. So we had shiitake, reishi, chaga, misima. I'm pulling a blank right now.
Maitake.
And I'm sorry, I'm pulling a blank right
That's
now.
Right.
So this is what happens when you're on spot on the radio, right? So, but we grow about 500 species in our culture library. And we have a 17 species blend. And don't ask me to name all the species right now because that would really push my memory.
Well, why don't we have people start by just reading the book?
Mm-hmm. I have a book called Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. And that book covers in great detail habitat restoration as well as the medicinal properties of mushrooms. And we have a website at fungi.com that covers a lot of this in detail. There's a lot of YouTube videos and other information and third-party references that people can delve into.
Paul, thank you very much for all your good work.
And thank you, Gary.
And my guest, Paul Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S, and you have his website, you have his book, and you have some ideas now that taking combinations of mushrooms is what he's advocating, synergistic reactions, because each one has a different property that can benefit the immune system. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. And that article today, I want everyone to know that we have all those articles, including Matthew's article, posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, so you can take your time and read through all of it. Have a nice day, everyone.